Welcome to the new Cyber Frontier, bringing you the latest news on the local Colorado economy and initiatives that focus on the development of cybersecurity economics. You don't have to be a computer or cybersecurity expert to get plugged in. Your host, Chris Gorog, brings it straightforward, asks the tough questions, and brings the cyber world to a level of understanding for everyone. Chris is personable and opens up with our guests on the issues we all would like to see addressed. You can find us on the web at www.newcyberfrontier.com. Now join our host as he introduces the topic for today's New Cyber Frontier.
Welcome to today's episode of New Cyber Frontier. On today, we're going to be talking about maritime cybersecurity. We have our guest, Nick Anderson, CISSP, GSLC, a couple more that we're not going to go through them all. But Nick is a board member for the Center for International Maritime Security, CIMSEC, and also the VP of Corporate Strategies at Invictus International Consulting. Nick, welcome today. Thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Sure, I am too, definitely. With my background, I spent some years in the Navy. If I haven't said that on the show before, I probably have. But the whole oceanic and the maritime aspect of engineering has always been an interest, because when I was in that world, it was everything you did. But now that I'm, you know, a drylander, we'll say, you don't hear much about it. You're not involved much. It seems like it's its own thing happening out there, but it's not. It's so interdependent into our culture. With all the shipping and things we use daily. But Nick, first of all, give us your background. Tell us how you got to where you're at and working in this the CIMSEC.
Absolutely, thanks. So I actually started out earlier in my career as an active duty Marine, and that gave me the opportunity through my deployments to places like Iraq and my postings overseas, and eventually coming back stateside and working around D.C. To begin, as well as maturing as a technology professional, to begin to work within the field of cybersecurity as well. So I eventually worked as the chief security officer for a cybersecurity nonprofit focused on work and integration between what we're doing here in the United States and what our international partners are doing, kind of providing a forum for mutual discussion and education. And worked for the federal governments, as well as a couple of consulting and contracting firms. Ran a little bit of independent business as well, eventually culminating in serving as the CIO for Coast Guard Intelligence here in D.C., as well as a Department of the Navy senior executive in the Pentagon, working as the CIO for Naval Intelligence. And that's really where I've had the opportunity to begin to focus on cybersecurity within the maritime domain and its impacts not only to federal organizations like DOD and DHS, but also its impacts throughout the rest of the United States, its economy, and all of our international partners.
Yeah, so the first thing you think of is with shipping is all the things we get from overseas. And, you know, I was in the store the other day, and I realized that half of the fruit section in the grocery store are from South America. All these blackberries and the vegetables that they must come in real time or just in time marketing or shipping, but they have to come in through a port. How dependent are we nowadays on that type of international shipping for our daily lives?
Yeah, we're critically dependent on the ability to move goods and people throughout the maritime domain. Just to give you one example, we have a dozen ships or more that handle more than $1 billion worth of goods each day just within the port of Los Angeles and Long Beach, Port LAX. It's certainly our nation's busiest seaport. But just within that individual port a day, we have $1 billion worth of goods coming to the United States. That's impacts, as you mentioned, within the agricultural industry, imports with things that lots of people look forward to, like the new iPhones that'll be coming over with the new launch being announced, automobiles, you name it. it's traversing through our nation's major seaports and has impacts, you know, throughout industry segments that we probably couldn't even go through them all here today.
Wow. So let's take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the top cybersecurity needs and problems that that Nick is seeing with maritime cybersecurity. Be right back after we talk to our sponsors.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Cyber Resilience Institute helps build strong cyber communities designed to prevent members from attack. Like building a neighborhood watch, it takes coordination and a sharing community to protect our identities and valuables in the virtual world. Typically, we hear that organizations know they need to do something to protect their cyber assets, but don't know where to begin. Let Cyber Resilience Institute help your community create an action plan. Cyber Resilience Institute will build your community or business marketplace so that it is designed to support a collective cyber defense. Contact them for more information at cyberresilienceinstitute.org.
All right, welcome back. We are talking to Nick Anderson, the board member for the Center of International Maritime Security. So, Nick, we got an intro. We understand the criticality of what we're depending on for international maritime transportation. And you look at the cyber aspects. What do you see as the primary industry problems that are critical or we need to be the most concerned about when it comes to cybersecurity in this maritime engineering environment?
Yeah, I think it's overall, if you're to put it all in one big bucket, it's securing our nation's maritime transportation system. And that looks at security and safe operation of vessels, a secure operation of the seaports, like we've already talked about, places like the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, the terminals themselves, and all of the related infrastructure, both used on the government side, used by our ports authorities, used by industry, and used by individual consumers and suppliers to make sure that they're actually able to provide for the movement of goods and the flow of commerce back and forth.
Yeah. So if we looked at those one at a time, the ships, they're almost at a point where they're autonomous, running on GPS all around the world. Is that the case? How much are we dependent on computer systems to entirely drive a good percentage of the ships out there?
Yeah, absolutely. So you know, there are several concepts that are out there. Just like we continue to have the debates and look at the testing here on land for things like self-driving cars, you know, there are companies like Rolls-Royce that have unveiled concepts of fleets of self-driving drone ships that they see coming to bear within the next several years, being piloted and crewed through virtual bridges and land-based control centers. So when you look at concepts like that of the future, of reducing the required crew on board a ship, freeing up time, freeing up resources, freeing up money to be able to operate those from a land-based control center, it becomes critically dependent to make sure that we're examining the cybersecurity risk that's inherent with those future concepts. Today, when you look at the integrated nature of our systems that are providing relevant real-time information to merchant mariners, to ship operators, to those captains all throughout the world, you're really talking about the ability for people to rely on good information to make decisions regarding the safety and security of people operating at sea. You know, we look at heartbreaking incidents in recent history like the McCain, and we see, you know, the impacts of what can happen with a ship collision. We have to make sure that people have the best and most reliable information available to make those decisions. Now, that was not a cybersecurity-driven event. That's something the Navy has gone publicly through and has talked about. But when we look at our ability to make positive decisions regarding navigation of the vessels while they're at sea, it's critically important. Sometimes there's not a high degree of latitude. There's not a whole lot of room for error when people are navigating in and out of ports. When we look at things like depth, and the ability to make sure that the ship's not going to run aground. Mm-hmm. We look at the position of other ships that are around us so we can provide awareness of the environment in which we're operating. We're talking about environmental hazards as we look at the flow of increased ship traffic in the Arctic. And that's an economic and commercial impact as cargo looks to use that transit route. And it's a tourism impact as well. Mm-hmm. The ability to be able to understand where ice is and where we can safely navigate is critically important, as well as being able to understand ship positional data at any given time. And that's for a number of reasons, both to be able to understand traffic and the conditions. If I'm piloting a vessel, I would need to understand where other people are, but also for tracking of the time in which a vessel will arrive, because there's only so much throughput and availability for a port to be able to load and unload cargo from some of these mammoth vessels that are coming in delivering all these goods. And also for security and for safety. We need to understand where those people are at any given time. So if we have to participate in something like a search and rescue operation, last known good positions, and being able to understand who else is in the local area that might be able to assist most quickly, where that time is so critical, is really, really important. And mm-hmm. being able to secure those systems and provide an assurance as to the level of reliability of that information that shipmasters and people that are involved in the associated industry are using, that's the core of it.
Yeah, and I think that was the second one we're talking about there is kind of like a supply chain tracking or distributed supply people, products, crates, different ships, the logistics of everything. Tracking where it's all been, where it's come from, where what ports you might have been, what you've been exposed to, what the crew might have been exposed to. All that is just a big logistics mess.
It absolutely is. And when we look at the ability to use data in real time or near real time to make very important decisions, it's easy for us not to think about that day to day. But there is a captain of the port exercising authority as the senior Coast Guard member, making decisions as to which ships come in and which ships leave, and what cargo or people might present some sort of risk or threat to the United States and our prosperity. They're making those decisions based on the best data that they have available. And you know, we have a mandate to make sure that they have the best data available to make those decisions. Whether that is labeling of certain cargo as dangerous or hazardous cargo that might need to be screened and verified for accuracy before it disembarks and comes into our port, whether it's making a decision of which vessels might need to be boarded or inspected before they're allowed into the port, or when we look at crises that we've faced over the last several years, the Ebola crisis was a great example of this. It's critically important to make sure that we're understanding the health impacts of cargo disembarking in our ports or for people disembarking in our ports. That could be commercial cruise liners, that could be cargo ships and their crew. We need to be able to provide a high level of assurance that we understand which crew members may have embarked on that vessel, that have embarked or have recently been in one of those Western Africa Ebola-affected hotspot zones that we saw, or maybe there was cargo that was coming on there, and we needed to make sure we understood the timelines so that we can see, was it within that 21-day window where we needed to be able to see if symptoms had begun to set in? We saw it as well with the cruise liner that had the nurse who embarked after handling patient waste from an Ebola-affected patient. And we saw the impacts of that, where South and Central American countries were not willing to have that cruise liner make port calls. to their region because of the potential health impacts, because they didn't have the quantifiable data to be able to prove that there was lower limited risk for allowing that ship to make a port call. When we look at the economic impacts of that, if we don't have data available and we can't clear a ship to be able to come in to the region because we haven't been able to protect our systems, because the systems might not be available, because data isn't as reliable as it possibly can be, because we can't assure the integrity of the data, suddenly that becomes a big impact. If you have, let's take the port of LALB, again, from our original example earlier, if I have $1 billion worth of cargo that's sitting offshore each day that I cannot provide the level of assurance to clear it to come into a port, that's a lot of rotting, wasting agricultural imports. We're talking about impacts in money, impacts for people here within our nation being able to just go get the food in the way that they're used to being able to get food. As you mentioned, you see just how many things within your local supermarket are being imported from foreign lands. We're critically dependent on the maritime transportation system and its existence to enable that maritime commercial traffic.
Yeah. Well, let me stop here. We're going to take a break and hear from our sponsor. When we come back, though, we're going to talk about what this means to the average person. And we'll be right back after we hear from our sponsors.
We'll be right back with the rest of today's show right after these brief messages from our sponsors. Over 3 million data breaches happen every single day. That's over 2,000 records being compromised every minute. So often, we focus on securing web data access. But what if the attackers are already inside, having gained direct access to your storage through data management software? When it comes to communications that go directly into your storage devices, make SNIA your first line of protection. SNIA's conformance testing limits outdated communications that are known to be used by attackers. It works continuously behind the background to make sure your storage is protected. To find out if your data is truly secure, visit our website at www.snia.org/cybertest.
So welcome back. We're talking to Nick Anderson from the Center for International Maritime Security. And we want to get into talking about, you know, how this impacts people. But I know that we've already had some cyber incidents that just came to mind when you were talking. But Port of Houston was shut down on accident by a hacking attack where the hacker was actually going after something else, and it was like collateral damage off to the side. Boom, shut down a whole port. What is the impact and the probability of this happening all over the world?
Yeah, so it's, you know, I don't know that we'd ever be able to say that there's a high degree of probability that might happen. But the, you know, the possibility of lateral movement of exploiting thing A that, you know, that somebody might be going after, and having them accidentally, as they kind of began to surveil and, you know, recon the, you know, the general area, move to thing B that might happen to be some of the systems that are supporting Seaport. That's a possibility in any industry. It's just the, you know, the impacts that we see here with Seaport terminals is incredibly high. Now we see, because you mentioned Houston, and you see the impacts that any one Seaport can have. It can be devastating should that happen either intentionally or accidentally.
Yeah. Yeah, so if I'm the average person, I mean, if we're not involved with maritime operations, we just think the food shows up on the shelves. What is it that somebody that is just listening to this can say, wow, how could I get involved? How could I be proactive in any kind of a risk or problem that would come out of this that would impact me directly? What would you recommend?
Yeah, so I think if you know, you look at the impacts for a normal person, maybe isn't thinking about maritime industry or, you know, isn't living, you know, close to big water. You know, just think about 90% of world trade. 90% is the percentage of world trade that is transported by sea, with ships and ports and our navigable waterways acting as, you know, the supporting infrastructure for the global economy. When we look at something like Houston potentially shutting down, you know, and I live up here in, you know, Northern Virginia, when we look at the impacts that something like Hurricane Harvey has had on the Gulf and the ability for oil production to operate, for the port to regularly operate, we look at the impacts of things like that, I'm paying more for my gas up here. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's just one port, one regionally, one regional event that hasn't necessarily affected, you know, the weather or operations here in Northern Virginia, but I'm feeling the economic impact of that every time I go to fill up my car. There have been several kind of social experiments recently where people have taken all the food off the shelves in a supermarket and said, you know, if we, you know, get tougher on trade, if we get tougher on immigration or whatever it might be, here are all the fruits and vegetables or meats or whatever it might be that are available here within the U.S. only. And, you know, irrespective of your position socially on the messaging behind why somebody is doing that, it's a stark realization for many people to look at, these are all the things that are affected if I can't provide for the safe import of those goods into the country.
Yeah, you said it's like 90% of the things are going to be off the shelves. Is that a good equivalent?
Well, I don't know that 90% of the things are off the shelves, but the 90% of our world's trade, so that's imports and exports. You know,
okay.
Because we have a lot of things that we make here inside the United States that are also exported goods elsewhere, which would have an economic impact here. You know, maybe if we're making,
gotcha.
I don't know what it might be. Maybe we're making boats, or we're making ATVs, or, you know, BMW, for instance. BMW's SUVs are manufactured in Greenville, South Carolina. They're not manufactured anywhere else. You know, if we can't get those SUVs out the door and shipped somewhere, wherever they might need to go, you know, it's going to provide economic impact right there in Greenville, South Carolina, which isn't touching the coast and our nation's you know, larger waterways at all.
Yeah.
So 90% of that world trade moves by sea, though. And I don't know that we have the capacity through air travel, for instance, to be able to, you know, supplement in a long-term, sustainable way, a supplement to major ports and waterways being shut down for any given extended period of time.
Yeah. So let's kind of move on. We'll say, what do we need to do to control or to mitigate the risk? What are your biggest risks you see from a cybersecurity standpoint that we need to say these need to be addressed, and society needs to know, legislators need to know, people making decisions need to know that we need these things to be addressed?
Yeah, you know, I think it's minimum standards. You know, when we look at many other industries, you know, the financial industry, for example, not even looking at the way that the government operates and maintains its own systems, just look at industries like financials. Our finance industry has several different elements that provide minimum standards that they must meet and they must adhere to, and it's inspectable and it's regulated, and they're responsible to somebody who's going to provide an independent assessment of whether or not they're meeting that standard. I think we really have to look at elements of our critical infrastructure as a nation that could also benefit from minimum standards, from shared intelligence or information. I use intelligence loosely here. Shared intelligence or information that can provide benefit of awareness of the threats that can affect them as an industry. We do the same thing with our aviation security organizations, where we look at providing information of new potential terrorist plots that may arise that may affect the safety of passengers and the secure operation of our airliners. With our maritime industry, providing the minimum standards that they might be able to meet, where for ports and facilities and terminals, there are already things like physical security standards for things like fences, video cameras, guards, certain physical protections that are typically in place and are well regulated and inspected. I think as organizations throughout the government mature, we need to see those same minimum standards and prescribed best practices, as well as potentially threat information sharing, become much more widespread. And it's a two-way street. It's people like government and regulators pushing some of that to industry, and I think it's also industry beginning to stand up and recognize that there's much more than just a bottom line impact for themselves, but a wider impact where they can be reaching out as well to become leaders and developing themselves in the industry in this way.
Okay, very interesting. And I've learned a lot today talking to you as well. As far as on your personal side, you have your own company, or you work for your VP of Corporate Strategies at Invictus International Consulting. Talk to us about what you do and what type of customers you have, who could reach out to you, and what services you offer.
Yeah, absolutely. So Invictus International is a company that is largely focused on national security, intelligence, cybersecurity, and technology service offerings. So we're headquartered out of Old Town Alexandria here in Northern Virginia, but we have customers and clients all over the world where we have people that are providing services both to government clients and to commercial clients. We've done business in New York City with financial sector and Houston with oil and gas, and with our national security community and our homeland community, where we were even recently recognized by GovCIO magazine, one of the top 10 homeland security service providers for 2017. So I think people can reach out to us for any number of services, whether it's just consulting services to come in and help them assess their own level of risk and perhaps where they're sitting today and best practices they can take on, like some of our commercial clients have. Or they can bring us in for managed services, where we'll provide those services to them in-house, or we'll provide regular penetration testing, red teaming, vulnerability assessments, and the like, to either help them meet their regulatory requirements or to just ensure that they're keeping themselves adequately protected in accordance with best practices and what we can observe and demonstrate as vulnerabilities within their own infrastructure.
Okay. Well, there you go. Feel free to reach out. You want to give a website that somebody or an email address that somebody can reach out to you at?
Sure, absolutely. So I can be reached at nick.anderson, A-N-D-E-R-S-E-N. I make it a little bit difficult for people to find me with the E-N. that's at Invictus, I-C-I-N-V-I-C-T-U-S-I-C.com. And that's also our website, or for our SIMSEC brethren with the Center for International Maritime Security, which I think you mentioned I'm on their board. It's SIMSEC.org, C-I-M-S-E-C.org. They're actually going through some pretty interesting discussions as we go through articles and focus weeks, based on some of the things we may have talked about here today. Cyber threats to navies was a recent sea control article that we had on there, and also discussions about future technology and things like artificial intelligence, and will it be disruptive to the way that we've conducted war as a nation over the last several years. So it's lots of good information there.
Yeah. Is there anything that SIMSEC needs people to reach out to them for, to engage with, or events that you have type of things on the calendar coming up?
Yes, we absolutely have a terrific chapter program for local in-person interaction with different focus areas, different events, different areas, and that's both within the U.S. and we have international chapters as well that people can find. We're always looking for authors to submit articles for review and publication there through SIMSEC as a platform. And of course, as a nonprofit, we're always on the hunt for sponsorship opportunities and for the opportunities to engage with people in the strategic discussions of how we can better provide for the security of our international maritime domain.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining today, Nick. I definitely have learned a lot myself. Appreciate you doing it. Thanks. The views or opinions expressed by me during this podcast are my own and are not those of my employer, Colorado Technical University.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of New Cyber Frontier. Remember to get involved. Often we think that someone else will handle privacy and security in the virtual world, but you are the only one truly in command of your virtual fate. Join our mailing list so we can keep you informed of breaking news and new releases. If you have an idea, if you have a question that you would like to hear answered, or if you want to get involved with our efforts, reach out to us at newcyberfrontier.com. We also encourage you to visit our sponsors' links, as they are the ones that really make this show possible. I want to thank each of you for supporting the show, and we look forward to seeing you back for the next episode of New Cyber Frontier.